So my name is Daniel Egan. I want to thank you guys for coming to the final session of the day. I appreciate it. I will make sure I get you guys out of here by 5:15 so you can go and have fun and do what you're going to do. I have an ulterior motive. These two are on the way. They're on a plane right now coming to see me. So I want to be out of here by 5:15 as well. So they look happy, right? They're coming to Disney World. So it should be a fun couple of days. So this is our agenda. This talk is not a 100 talk. It's not a 400 talk. There's kind of jumbled in there a bunch of things about the BOT framework. Part of it's kind of an intro. Part of it's talking about best practices. Part of it's going to be talking about scenarios. So I'm not going to walk you step by step through building a BOT. For one, without a chair, it's kind of hard to code. I'm going to show code. And for two, if you want to go step by step, I have on my GitHub a workshop. It was actually the workshop we did on Saturday. But it steps you through step by step by step to build a BOT from beginning to end, whether you want C# or Node. So if you want to do that, feel free to download that after, and I'll put up on the ending slide as well. But the thing I like to start with is bots are the new rage, like the new thing. And everyone's, you know, thinking about how hot they are. They're not. I like to tell the history in technology, and this is my history of bots. I'm stretching it slightly, but it's still the lineage of bots. So who knows who this person is? Anybody? This is, actually, in all the talks I've done, only one person who this was. This is Lord Byron. Lord Byron, if you do not know who he is, you probably know his work called Don Juan. And the reason it starts with Lord Byron is because it really starts with his daughter. So Lord Byron was a scoundrel, and he actually left about 4 months after his daughter was born. He was kind of a bad guy and not very good at anything except for writing, of course. And so his wife wanted their daughter not to follow in his footsteps and wanted to make sure that she did not go down the same path he did. So she forced mathematics on her, lots and lots and lots of mathematics on her. His daughter was Augusta Byron, and when she grew up, after all those classes and tutors and everything, she married William VIII Baron King. In 1838, he became the Earl of Lovelace. She became Augusta Ada King, Noelle, Countess of Lovelace, or as you know her, Ada Lovelace. Now, where this starts tying into it is Ada Lovelace, by some, is considered the first computer programmer because she had a friendship with a gentleman called Charles Babbage, who is known as the father of the computer. He was known as the father of the computer because he's known for two different things: the difference engine, which he did build, which is a mechanical calculator that could calculate numbers faster than any human could, and the analytical engine. Now, the analytical engine was the first programmable computer. Now, they were friends, and he asked her to write notes on a paper that was written by another mathematician about the analytical engine, and she did. And she wrote, and she wrote, and she wrote. Her notes on it were probably five times the size of the actual paper. And in there was a lot of different things in there, reasons they think she's or is considered the first programmer, etc. But one of the things she said in there was that the analytical engine has no pretensions whatever to originate anything. It can do whatever we know how to order it to perform. It can follow an analysis, but it has no power of anticipating any analytical relations to the truth. It can never have artificial intelligence. Now, this irked a lot of people. One of the main people it irked was Alan Turing. Now, Alan Turing, considered the father of artificial intelligence, developed what's called the Turing test. Now, the Turing test is really simple. Put a person in one room, another person in another room, and a computer in a third room. And if you cannot figure out which one's the person and which one's the computer, it's considered intelligent. And so, in 1964, at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, the first chatbot was born, and this was Eliza. And Eliza's sole purpose was to try and trick people, or at least that was the pretense of why they built it. And Eliza was a therapist, so the thought was, basically, you know how therapists talk. You say, you know, they ask you, say a question, say, well, how does that make you think? How does that make you feel? What do you think about that? So it's very easy to kind of pattern a bot to talk like a therapist and possibly fool someone. The second chatbot was Perry. Now, Perry was based on a paranoid schizophrenic. And once again, they can kind of say anything, right? So how can you tell the difference between someone who's just shouting gibberish and a computer that's shouting gibberish? And so if you have a therapist and you have a paranoid schizophrenic, they, of course, need to talk. And so the two first chatbots talked to each other. I think it was in 1974. And this is part of their conversation. So chatbots are not new. Like anything else in technology, they're not new. But they had a fundamental problem. They weren't very useful. And the reason they weren't useful is because text-based adventure games. How many have ever played a text-based adventure game? Okay. When you played a text-based adventure game, you had to say, go left, grab chair, open door, turn knob. If you varied off of that at all, it had no idea what you're talking about, and it would just say stupid stuff again and again. It would annoy you. Now think of bots. If you're asking a bot a question and it says, I don't understand, and you ask it again, it says, I don't understand. You ask it again, it says, I don't understand. You ask it again, it says, I don't understand. You're getting annoyed that I keep doing it, right? If you have a bot that's doing that, people are going to get annoyed at the bot, and they're not going to use it, right? It's got to be able to speak with us. So NLP to the rescue. And it's NLP, not NLP. And I put this up here for a reason, because if you search NLP, you're going to get neuro-linguistic programming and not natural language processing. So if you're interested in this later, make sure you type in the whole word. Otherwise, you're going to get Tony Robbins a bunch. So what is NLP? It's a way for people to be able to talk to computers. It's a way for computers to understand what we mean, what we're trying to say, what we're trying to ask. So why is it so hard? Think of a very simple question. I saw a man on a hill with a telescope. For you and me, that's kind of easy to grasp, especially when we have context of the world around us. But that statement can mean there's a man on a hill and I'm watching him with my telescope. There's a man on a hill who I'm seeing and he has a telescope. There's a man and he's on a hill that also has a telescope on it. Or I'm on a hill and I saw a man using a telescope. Computers don't understand what we're trying to say, or it's very difficult. Or if we make it more concrete of something you might build, you know, in the enterprise, this is a bot that helps surface sellers sell stuff. If you think of the first one, has my order number 1549 been shipped yet? That's relatively easy to parse. But look at the third one. Do you sell Acer laptops and drives? Am I saying, do you sell Acer laptops and Acer drives? Or am I saying, do you sell Acer laptops and also drives? Now, the last one, you can see I said, what kind of display is on a Surface 4? There's two things that you need when you're talking about natural language. And the cool thing about it is its simplicity. You need to derive the intent of what they're asking, and then you need to pull out the entities of it. And on that last one, if you look at it, the intent is they want to know about features for this, you know, particular program, and the entities are display and Surface 4. Now, as developers, you know what to do with that, right? You grab that information, and you can query your database to get that information, right? But you have to be able to not force people using regular expressions to say exactly like what you want, like a text-based adventure game. You want to say them to be able to say, yo, what kind of display is on that Surface thing, right? Or, you know, however they want to say it, you need to be able to handle those things. And again, not using regular expressions. So that's where our cognitive services comes in. There's a whole suite of stuff. In this talk, we're going to talk about two of them. The first one is called Lewis, which is our natural language processor. Another one we're going to look at today, if we have time, is sentiment analysis. And so the way this works is, again, you got to remember we need to determine intent and define entities. Now, the UI has changed a little bit, but I've kept this here anyway. because it fits nicely on the screen and it shows what I want. And I'm going to actually start it over so you can see. So on the left, if this is for the surface sellers, you can see I have intents of, are they asking about a promotion? Do they need help? Are they looking for features? Are they asking about a price? And it could be more than that. And then you can see my entities are product type, feature type, and accessory type. So you put all those in there, and then you just start asking it questions. You know, I can say something stupid like, what can you do? That's still an intent I want to capture. This person needs help. And then you can answer that with either humor or really give them, tell them what you need, what they can ask, right? You can see that I'm asking something I haven't asked before. Are you good for something? It's, again, going to predict that I want the help intent. But now we want to ask something, you know, real that someone would ask. And so here we're going to say, you know, what kind of display is on Surface, I think I say 2 or 3 here. And one of the interesting things is Surface and the number are two different things, right? So I've trained this to understand when it has Surface and a number, it treats those as one thing. And you can see that obviously it grabbed the entities and it has the right intent. And so I'm going to ask it one more time. Or I'm going to train it. Actually, down on the bottom on the left, you can see I click the train button. And then you train your model. And the cool thing is, the more data you have, the smarter it gets. So you train it a bunch yourself with questions you know they'll ask. And then as people start using your app, it'll get smarter and smarter and smarter and smarter, because you can go back once they ask the questions, and if it didn't categorize it the right way, you recategorize it, and it learns and learns and learns. And what it does, interestingly enough, is at the top of this list, it'll give you the ones that it thinks that it can learn the most from. Now, what happens is you publish it, and it gives you a URL. Here I am typing the same question here in kind of a test bed, because I want to show you what actually comes back. What kind of display? We're just going to ask the same question. It's on a Surface 3. And what you get back is JSON, right? And so you can just parse this JSON. Now, we're talking about bots, but you can use Lewis for anything you want. You can see it gives me the query. It gives me the score of how confident it thinks it is for the intent. It gives me the entities that are coming out. It also gives me the scores of the other intent. So if something's close and me in my programming want to decide, no, I want that one instead of this one, I can do that stuff. And again, if you're gathering a lot of different entities, you can loop through the entities, make a call to the database. Now, if we look at how this works in the bot, it works exactly as you'd expect, and we'll look at that in a little bit. This is an emulator for the bot framework, and I'm asking it in the emulator. It's going to go up to Lewis. It's going to come down to my bot. My bot's going to fetch it from the database. It's going to show it on screen, right? So the reason in a bot framework talk I'm starting with Lewis is, to me, that's really what's helping bots become the new apps, becoming the new enterprise apps, is the ability to capture things the way people would naturally say them. Now, this is called in the bot framework an intent recognizer, especially in the Node SDK. And this is actually really important. We'll get back to this later when we talk about kind of real world apps and how you build them. And basically what it's doing is allowing me to intercept, you know, what's being said and determine what to do with it. And Lewis is implemented as an intent recognizer. So let's talk about the bot framework now. The bot framework is 3 different things, kind of 2. The third one's a bot directory, where once you're done, you can publish it in the bot directory. But it's really the 2 of them. So let's talk about the developer portal first. The developer portal is simply where you register your bot, you post the URL of where your bot is located, and you set up the channels, which we'll talk about. You can manage here, you can test here, you can view analytics for your bot here. And then you have the bot framework SDK itself, and we're going to talk a lot about that. If we look at the X-ray of a typical bot, this is what I love, is your bot's in that bot code, just a little small piece. Everything else you know and you already do is in your skill set. So building a bot is no stretch for any developer, whether you're a C# one or a Node developer. It's not a stretch at all. You can see we're making calls out to Cognitive Services. You can make calls out to your own services. And on the right-hand side is what we call channels. And channels are just the platforms that you can communicate over. The Skypes, the Kicks, the Slacks, the Telegrams, the GroupMes, the Microsoft Teams, Direct Line, which we'll talk about. And here is the beauty of the bot framework. I've done talks at botathons and bot groups and stuff, and they're like, man, we wish you had this when we started programming. Because if you build a bot with the Facebook SDK, which is a great SDK, and say you wanted a Slack bot, do you know what you have to do? You have to build your bot over again. And then you wanted it on Kick. You know what you have to do? You have to build it again. Now, there's probably some code you can put somewhere that it shares, but this is, to me, the beauty of the bot framework, because it allows you to do it once and have it on all the channels that you, your company, or your customers want it on. You know, because we know customers and companies are fickle. You know, one day they'll want it on one platform, and the next day they want it on the other. And so what you can do is take 5 minutes, add a channel, bill for 3 weeks, just kidding, and deliver it to them. So this is the beauty of the bot framework. Now, this is how it does it. There's something in the middle called the connector service. So as you can imagine, all those platforms, all those channels, as we call them, didn't sit down in a room and go, hey, let's call this field this, and this field this. We're going to have our JSON and our communications exactly the same. They didn't do that. So we're doing that for them. From the channels, we have what's called channel JSON. Whatever data they're passing along and whatever fields they call them coming along, and they go to our connector service. Our connector service transfers it into what's called activity JSON that the bot framework understands. And then when you're talking back to the channel, it translates it back. So that's how it is able to be on all those platforms all at once. But the reason I point this out, and I'm very explicit on the slide, because in code, if you look at it, this is the connector service. It's just a using statement, right? As a C# developer, you know, you're kind of used to things being hidden from you, right, a bit. But that one line of code does a ton of stuff for you. Node is the same way. It's just one line of code creating a connector in Node. So let's actually look at a couple bots. Are there any Node developers in here? Yeah? Okay, a couple. Good. So let's start with C#. I already have this up. Just because it's a file new, there's a template for the bot framework, just a file new C# application, bot application. Do I have to do something to show? What's that? I was. Let's see. There we go. Okay, so if you look at visual, and I like that no one said anything as I'm talking and nothing's on the screen. When were you guys going to tell me? Some point, I hope. So if you look at a bot application and you're a C# developer, you will be absolutely positively comfortable in here. There's a few things you'll need to learn. But you can see it just has message controllers. It has a root dialog. If we look at the message controller itself, you can see that we're just getting a post, and when a post comes in here, we're getting activity. That's that activity JSON file, basically, that we talked about that has all the information of where the what channel it's on, who it's coming from, the idea of it, all that stuff. When we get it, most of the time you're going to be dealing with a message. What's the text that's coming through that I have to deal with, right? And when that comes through and it's a message, I'm just going to send it to this root dialog. There's other stuff that can happen. You can see down here, when someone wants their data deleted, or someone joins a conversation, or a contact is added in Skype, all that stuff you can handle as well. But most of the time, you're just dealing with messages. and it'll go to the root dialogue. And we'll talk about dialogues in a bit. And dialogues in C# just need a couple of things. They need to be serializable, and they need to implement the iDialogue. iDialogue has one method, which is start async. So when you go into this dialogue, it goes in that method. You tell it what to do. You got some text. What do you want to do with it? How are you going to answer it? Our example of the Surface 4, you're going to get in the message that has those intents and the entities. We'll talk about that later. You go to the database, and you send back the image and the text, right? So writing a bot is super simple. Let's look at Node. In Node, it's even simpler. Node, you're just bringing in a couple requires for Bot Builder and Restify. We're creating a server with Restify. We're telling it, in this case, what port to look on. You'd say what use environment variables and stuff like that to figure out the port, but making it easy here. We're creating a connector. That's the thing we just talked about. And we're newing it up. We're telling it where it's going to be posted to, which is that localhost 3978 and API messages. And when it does, it's going to come to this dialogue. Again, we only have a default dialogue, or in this case, a root dialogue, just like the C#. So super simple to build a bot. So on the subject of building bots, you have to make sure that your bot has a clear purpose. Because we talked about natural language processing, but when people start utilizing it, they abuse it. They try to capture anything and everything a user could possibly ever say. That's not the best use of natural language processing, because it won't work. You'll drive yourself crazy. You'll have like 100 intents that capture a third of what they can do. So make sure when you build your bot, just like when you build an app, it has a purpose. There's a sample bot out there called AzureBot. It has a single purpose, and it may sound silly to have an AzureBot, but there's a really great use case. And the use case is you're managing your servers. You have the day off, you're at Disney World with your kids, and one VM is causing a bunch of problems, right? You just have your phone with you. What are you going to do? Take it out and VPN in and kind of scroll the image and try and look for it and that blade. Oh, I can't close that blade, right? Or do you pop open Skype, say list my VMs, find the one, and type in shut down VM, right? That is a great use case. And the beautiful part about this is you're not having to build this for Android or all the different versions of Android, iPhone, Windows Phone, Windows, all of that, because that's all handled by Skype or Slack or Messenger, whatever channel you're using, right? That's all handled for you. So again, you write it once. Or if you think about, especially in the enterprise, I've been working with a lot of enterprises, and this is absolutely positively the number one thing they ask for. It helps improve workflows. How many of you work for a call center or your company has a call center? Yeah, it's a lot. Call centers are big business, and call centers are really tough. I worked at ADP for 8 years, and a lot of the things we did as developers there was trying to fix the flow of people coming in. And if you ever worked in a call center, 90% of the questions they have are exactly the same. You know, you can start with, did you reboot, right? A bot can do that, right? So you can have that first triage handled by a bot. So it says, my computer's not working. I see you're having a problem. Does it have power? You know, that's always a great one, too, and you would be surprised how many people didn't realize things were plugged in back in the day. But it can handle those things, and what happens is, if it's a more complex thing, you can pass that off to a human, right? There's kind of a middle tier of that, too. That's a simple, hey, can it answer these questions? If not, you know, we'll pass it off. Or there's always those 5 or 6 questions tech people need before they start. You can gather that. Or one of my favorites is you can interject into a chat stuff that the bot can get. So I know many of you have been on a tech call where it's someone brand new that is frustrating you because they're trying to go off a script. That's a perfect use case for a bot, again, because a bot can go search all the stuff that this new person has no idea about, looking at the text, deciding it might have to do with this, and give hints to the tech, right? And so that's what this is doing. So I have a sample here, and these samples it's four different pieces. So let me bring some of them up. So I have a web page that has, you've seen these before, it says, you know, where it says, do you want to chat with us? Do you need some help? Where these things pop up. This is something, or at least a proof of concept we started working on for a client, and it's using OLARC. There's a lot of different products you can use. So the second part is the back end of OLARC that any person or customer service using OLARC to manage this stuff would use. We have two projects. We have that page I just showed you is running up top here. And then obviously I have a bot running as well. And the bot is on my local machine. And so I have to be able to get to my local machine from the internet. And so I'm using ngrok to tunnel through. How many of you have never heard of ngrok? You need to come to me after this and hear about ngrok. I'll talk about it at the end if I have time, but I probably won't. You will not know what you did without ngrok. It basically allows you to tunnel to your local ports on your machine so you can do cool testing stuff like this. And if you're going to do bots, you absolutely positively have to use ngrok. So that's what's running on the bottom here. And let me make sure that the bot is actually running. It is. Okay. So like I said, there's four things running. And I want to explain one thing. You'll notice that there's the OLARC chat on the bottom right, and then there's a chat window on the bottom left. We normally hide this, right? Because what we're doing is we're using two things in the bot framework. Direct line, which is a channel, which allows you to integrate with anything that we haven't already made as a channel, and something called back channel, which allows us to intercept stuff coming across the web to this web page so we can do stuff with it. So what we're doing is we're grabbing stuff coming from OLARC and deciding whether we're going to send it to the bot or we send it to OLARC. And so I can't remember what state I left this in. So let me say hello. And that popped over here, and you can say, you know, do you need help? And that's how the normal chat would go. But I'm going to force it to do something else by in OLARC. We created some code. Calling force offline. And now when I type hello, you can see that it was didn't go to OLARC, although we actually send the data to OLARC. You'll see that I make OLARC aware of what the bot actually said. So the bot framework intercepted it and is now talking to the user through OLARC. Now, I'm not doing anything special. You can see I'm just saying hello, and it's just echoing back hello to me. But it's really pretty simple for you to intercept things like chats, build it into your own custom stuff. Now, one of the things I do when I talk about this, I love the bot framework for another reason. How many of you have a side hustle? How many of you want a side hustle? How many of you don't know what a side hustle is? Okay, I guess I've been working with startups too much. Side hustle is, in development, there's always those extra things you maybe do on the side, right? If you're not doing them for your company, you learn better by doing little projects. This is perfect for a side hustle, meaning that you have no idea how many companies that I talk to personally that want a bot, need a bot. Whether it's a funny bot that does something cool, whether it's an enterprise bot like this is a perfect thing for a side hustle because you're not building this big website CMS system for a client. It's, you want a bot? Hey, I can help you with that. So I love the bot framework for that. Okay. And now you know what a side hustle is too. Okay, let's talk about some bot facts. Number one, users love buttons. How many of you are like me and good developers, but when it comes to designing the front end, they're gray and square buttons and not very attractive? Okay, who never raises their hand no matter what I ask? Okay, I got the rest. That's another beautiful part. We're talking about the UI and buttons here, but that's another beautiful part. You don't have to design it. Because every single platform, whether it's Skype or Kick or Slack or the web chat, they decide what it's going to look like. You don't have to decide what a button looks like or a box looks like or an image looks like. They've already done all that UI because they want your bot to have the same UI as everything else on their platform, on Facebook, etc. But users like to be able to click things. We're in a touch world. And the thing about bots is you can type in what it asks for a button, or you can click the button. And there's something called directed or non-directed in a bot. Directed is feeding them from the moment they get in, "Hi, Daniel, welcome to the travel bot. I can book airline, hotel, car." Pick a button, right? And then when you get there, what type of car would you do? That's directed. You're not using natural language processing at all on that. A lot of companies like that because you're very specific, although you still can use natural language processing because there's an open text box and people are going to ask you anything at all and say whatever they want, and you can kind of capture that and handle it with humor. So even in a totally directed one, you can still use NLP to make it a better bot. And then there's the non-directed on the other way, where you leave it wide open. I will say this, never ever start your bot by saying, "How can I help you?" Because they don't know what your bot does. You have to direct it a little bit. But they love UIs, text second, and voice, as cool as it is, and it is, as it sounds, it's hard. It really is hard. You think having a computer understand natural language, typing is hard. When you start speaking to it, not only the difficulty in the translations, and we have great tools that do that, but people speak different than they type. They don't speak as direct as they even type. So that's why the voice is third. Unless for reasons like driving in a car and stuff, it's very helpful. Users never say things the way you expect. As developers, you're like, "Oh yeah, I can do NLP, I can do Lewis, and I can, you know, they can ask me if how many bedrooms, and we can pull, that's an entity, we can pull that out, and oh look, yeah, how many square feet they want, oh, we can figure out that entity, and you're programming away, programming away." But people are just going to say, "I want to find a house." And you've got to realize that's what they're going to say, and then you have to figure out the path from there. So they don't say things the way, especially a developer, would expect them to. Search is great for bots. So there's two things. The first one, I'm not going to demo because it's so simple. If this talk was called "Build a Bot in 5 Minutes," I could build a bot in 5 minutes that was amazing with Q&A Maker. Q&A Maker, to me, is additive to enterprise bots. It can stand alone, too, because what you do with Q&A Maker is you point it to an FAQ page. It scrapes the whole site. It grabs the whole, all the questions. It allows you to test it. And it has a natural language processor of its own on the front end. So people can ask questions that are kind of on your FAQ page that aren't worded the exact way that you have worded them. And you have answers. And people don't have to search this huge thing. And so what I use it with companies for is additive. If I didn't catch it here, catch it here, catch it here, maybe we have an FAQ that handles it, and then we surface that. And then search, the Azure search is great too, because it allows you to go over millions and millions of data points really quickly and gather stuff back super quick. Fact number four, don't think your bot has to fool anyone. As a matter of fact, don't try to fool anyone. Let them know it's a bot. In this day and age, especially people that are driving this chat revolution, which are the millennials, they don't need to talk to a person. If the bot is able to help them with what they want help with, they're fine with that. And most people are. So don't try to pass the Turing test and confuse people. You know, let them know they're talking to a bot. If it helps them, they'll be appreciative. So let's talk about dialogues. Dialogues are the guts of what you'll be programming when you program with Bot Framework. A dialogue is simply a dialogue, right? You're talking to the back end back and forth, right? Hi, I'm Dinnerbot. How can I help you? I would like to reserve a table. Great, let's get started. Conceptually, though, when you're programming it, it might be easier to think of it in this way, in this format. You could say, hi, how can I help you? And then you say, the question comes, I need to reserve a table. And this is where routing comes in. So that root dialogue that you saw should only really be used for routing it to other dialogues that handle specific things. And a dialogue is just a chunk of code. That's all I'm talking about, right? Don't let the word dialogue confuse you. If I know who you are already by the bot, I'm just going to go to my reserve dialogue and ask you all the questions that I need for reservation. If I don't know you, I'm going to go to a dialogue that does get user info, because I want to know who you are, and then I'll go, get the reservations, right? So that's what dialogues are. Dialogues form a chain. And why that's kind of important is this visual, to me, helps you understand all the different places you can persist data. So you can persist data, user data. That's specifically about me, right? I want to save data. I want to save the fact that my name's Daniel. So when I come back to the bot and says, hi, Daniel, what can I help you with today? Or if it's a birthday bot, I'm going to save the birthday too, right? Because then there's proactive messages that I can send a message without them saying anything to me and say, happy birthday. I know it's your birthday today. I hope you enjoy your day. Or whatever it is your business does, in user data is where you save user-specific data. Second one is conversation data. And you notice there's conversation data and private conversation data. Because in platforms like Skype, you can have multiple people in a conversation. So if it's just pertaining to a conversation with me and you're in there too, I want to do it as private conversation data. So you save those two things. And you're just saving state. And then finally, dialogue data, which will disappear when you're out of that dialogue. So if you just need to save data while you're still in a dialogue, while the dialogue's still on the stack, and you need to save it somewhere to manipulate it later, that's dialogue data. If you're a web developer, it might help to think of it as how you're building web pages. You can see you got your main screen, the root dialogue. You got your new order screen and your product search screen. Same thing for dialogues. The one important thing I'll say, though, is to remember that dialogues are stacked. And one of the reasons I kind of slow down and say this is because if I handle most questions in my root dialogue, and then I send them off to who can handle them, and I'm in the user info dialogue, and there's one line that calls context.done that says, take this off the stack, I'm done with it. And I don't call that, and the user asks another question. Now I'm in this dialogue that it doesn't understand how to answer those questions or route me anywhere, okay? So remember they're in stacks and don't get stuck in a stack. Make sure when you're done processing on that dialogue, you get rid of it. Now, as you can expect, you could blast away the whole stack if you want, if that's ever needed, and manipulate it in other ways. So form flow, I think the majority of you are C# developers, if I remember the hands correctly. I have a love-hate relationship with form flow. I love it. I truly do, and you will too. But use it with a warning. So form flow, and I'll show you a sample of it and exactly how it works. Form flow is probably the easiest way to do a dialogue, but the dialogue has to be specific. You got to know exactly what you need from that dialogue. Because the thing about form flow is if you do it in form flow and then form flow can't handle what you needed to do, you have to scrap it and start all over. So I'll just give you that warning. But it does what it does really well. And this is what it handles. So if you look at this conversation, what date would you like to reserve a table for? 12, 14, 17. For how many people? 4. What time? That's a normal flow, but that's not what happens. This is actually what happens. What date would you like the reservations for? 12, 14, 17. For how many people? Wait, I mean 2, 14, 17. He's gone. He's past that question. He he doesn't know what you're talking about. So this is a great thing that FormFlow does for you. And let's see what that looks like. And again, in that document bot workshop, I walk you through all of this. So if you want the steps on doing this, and it's actually in this thing called DinnerBot. So we have, these can be in the same thing, but I separate them out. So we have a model that's just a class, which is why C# developers love this. It's the easiest way to do it. You can see that I have a class. It's serializable. It has to be serializable to participate in the bot framework. You can see that one of the questions that I want to ask, I want to give them multiple options, so I'm using an enum for that. You can see that I have strings, decimals, numbers, and on top of it, I'm just adding some attributes. You can see I'm adding an attribute of what to actually ask for the question. You can see on line 31 there, I'm doing a regular expression, which I did not create myself, because I hate regular expressions. I go to a website and say, this is what I want, and it gives it to me. Some people like torturing themselves. I don't. And you can see you can set descriptions on it, but it's really just a class, right? These are the questions I want to ask for my reservation. Then there's the form itself. And in the form, I'm using something called a build form. And here, all I'm doing is I'm setting the order that I want the questions to be asked in. You don't actually have to do this. If you don't do this at all, setting the fields explicitly, it will ask them in the order that you have them in that class. That's what I mean. It's super intuitive for a C# developer. You can see these are normal ones. This one I'm breaking out and trying to validate the email. Instead of using a regular expression, I validate with a method here. I'm not going to show it to you. It's just an email validation method. I'm not adding all the forms. And at the end, I do build. Now, where this is called is simple too. In the root dialog, I just create it right here, create a form, a new form dialog of type reservation, which you saw. I'm actually passing in the name that I've already collected. In this one, if I don't have their name, I ask them that first. I save it in user data, so I know I have it in user data. And when they want the reservation, I don't want to have to ask them for their name again because they've already told me their name. So I'm passing it in there. I call the build form method that I just showed you. Some of the form options, it's not going to ask for name, but there's an option that I can say even if you have a value, prompt for it anyway, and that's it. I do a context that call, and that's how you call dialogues. And so you call the form flow just like you would a normal dialogue. I pass it the form, and then where to come back, the callback to come back. And so if I run this, and I use the emulator, just refresh it. You'll see down here, I get conversation update once when I join and once when the bot joins. And I say, yeah, it says hi to me. Okay, and then it gives me the options. I say reserve a table. Say, what's your email? Enter phone. And for this, I can say something like next Tuesday, and it's going to be able to capture that and know that. And then I'm like, I'm stuck, so I do help. And it'll tell me everything I can do, so I can go back to a specific question. I can do status to see what I've already filled out. I can ask for hints on everyone. You saw that even after I said help, it jumped down and says it still knows that I have to pick a time, so it's asking that question again. So you don't have to code any of that. Again, that's the beauty of FormFlow. But again, I have that love-hate relationship. And then what happens is I'll do 9 p.m., 5 people. Here comes our enum birthday. And I loved the experience, so I'm going to give it a 5. And then it gave, I printed it out in a card. and we'll talk about a card. This is a thumbnail card I think I'm using that allows me to present it in a nice way. Okay. So, talking about cards, I'm going to actually jump out again instead of showing you the slides. So there's a bunch of different cards you can use. That was a thumbnail card or a hero card, I can't remember. And if we look at what they look like, there's a video card, there's an animation card, there's an audio card. And this isn't the greatest picture. Let me maybe do... You know, so what it does is it allows you to present something nicely. Again, as someone who's not good at designing stuff, this allows you to present something that you don't have to figure it out. But the difficulty with these cards, and it's not just a difficulty with the bot framework, it's a difficulty wherever you use cards, is if my data does not fit this format, even though we have 5 or 10, then I have to try and figure out exactly what I want to do. And if you saw the build, anything's coming out of build, one of the things that came out is these things called adaptive cards. Adaptive cards allow you to stick to a particular format, meaning that you don't get to go all MySpace on the bots and have things like sparkly and do all that other stuff, right? Because that's what cards are meant to stop people from doing. But they do allow you to get a little more flexibility, and they allow you to design a card, and whatever platform it's on, it will format it in that way. So as great as like the hero and the thumbnail are, if you need to have more text, or you need a couple buttons, or you need to do anything, really, it allows you to do this. And it's really simple. I think I have a slide on this. I have a lot of slides on those, but I'm just going to bring it all out. So you have an outside container, and then you can add column sets to it, right? And in column sets, you can add a column to it. And in the column, you can add a text box, or you can add a button, or you can add a choose button, or you can add whatever. So it's very easy for you to design the card exactly how you want it. The difficult part is now, if you're like me and you're not that great at design, this might take you a little bit more to make it look as nice as what other people might design, because you still can do 3 ugly columns and not do it right. So that will be up to you. So that's adaptive cards. And if you want to see how those work, again, in that workshop, we walk through adaptive cards, all of that, and it'll take you through step by step. So finally, I want to talk about real-world projects. In the samples, and you can find a bunch of samples. Let me see if I have that here. Samples, obviously, on my bot workshop. There's a couple of them for the bot builder itself. There's samples inside the bot builder SDK, and there's also a bot builder samples link. And they're amazing, fantastic samples. But they do things very succinctly, meaning if you want to know about cards, there's a sample for cards. If you want to know about Skype, there's a sample for Skype. They don't necessarily create them in a real-world way, meaning that if you're a Node developer, a C-sharp developer, they're not architected like you would want them to be. And so I'm going to show you a couple that I have that do that. Let me stop this guy. And these are available on my GitHub, too, if you would want to look into this. So one of the things you'll notice in all the samples for the Node ones is absolutely, positively, everything is in app.js, right? So when you run the server and you run app.js, it's like everything's there. Dialogues there, intents are there, events are there. There's so much stuff I haven't even talked about. But if you've done any Node development, and I'm still a relative newbie to Node, quite honestly, for a year and a half or so, but I know how it should be architected, and I know how modules work in Node, and that dialogues themselves fit the concept of using one of those. And so you can see what we've done in this project is app.js is relatively small, and what we do in this app folder is we have a dialogues folder, and then the dialogues are just brought in when we need them. And so these are just in Node modules, and you just do a modules.export on them. These are relatively simple. You can see a features dialog that will search for features and then send back whatever features I'm searching for. One of the interesting things I want to talk about is recognizers, and I'll show you this in two places. Recognizers are like Lewis. Lewis is an intent recognizer. But you can write your own recognizers, and this is why you want to. You don't want to have to hit Lewis for every single question that a user asks. If they're saying hi, or hello, or hey, or simple things like that, or they send you an emoticon, you don't want to go up to Lewis to find out that they said hi. You can capture those in your own recognizer and then stack them. And again, we don't have time to go line by line through here, but you'll notice in our app.js here, this is where we load up all the dialogues, but we also have our stacking our intent recognizers. So one best practice is you can use natural language processing to determine what they want, but then teach them how to use their bot. You can say, great, I can find that for you. Next time, if you just say search feature, it'll be quicker. And then you can capture in a regular expression, search feature, not have to go to Lewis, get him the same exact information, right? And so we have a commands recognizer, a greetings recognizer, that one's that handles as many permutations of hi that we could think of. A smiles one, again, if they send an emoticon, I'm gonna send one back. And then it goes to Lewis after that. So it's not only for saving you money if you're on a paid tier on Lewis for every hit, but also you don't have to travel back and forth to it all the time. You keep it local. And for C#, it's the same thing. Although they don't have intent recognizers, so this is something called a scorable dialog. And it does something very similar to stacking the recognizers. And so you want to write that down, and you can get this code. It'll be up on my GitHub as well. But essentially what you do is you have scorable groups. You have this method, a bind attribute, that binds the method. And then you have scorable groups. And as messages come in, it's going to go to the zeroth scorable group first, which are just methods. You determine what's going on with it. If it's a message in this case, it's a message coming through, I need to handle it with my dialogues, I say continue next group. And it'll pass it down to the groups that are set up as a scorable group one. Now these are regex ones. So here's where I can capture, they said hi, they said hello, they said a command, they said whatever. And from here, I can handle it and then not do continue to next group, right? You can see on this line 89, I have that. So this would actually then go down to this last one, which is the Lewis dialogues. And so this is how, we didn't show you that whole thing, but this is how, whether you use the scorable dialogues or just Lewis intent dialogues, this is how you capture what's coming back from Lewis, is you put an attribute for Lewis intent, and whatever your intent is coming Lewis, you decorate it here, and it comes down in this method, and you handle what they said. So this is how in C#, you can do that as well and have that same nice pattern that you want in a good enterprise bot. So to wrap up, bots are hot. They're not necessarily new like we talked about at the beginning, but they are hot. And they're really a great way to, if you're in an enterprise and you add cool things, like, for example, one of the people that we worked with wanted a bot that worked with Jenkins, right? They wanted to be able to kick off builds and have messages come out when builds are finished or when they didn't finish and all that stuff. And so they wanted to be able, like Jenkins has, I think, Slack integration, but they wanted to work on other channels, right? And so they built a Jenkins bot. So it's not new, but it's hot, and there's a million ones out there that you can do. It's easy to build on your current skills. There's not a lot of new stuff you have to learn to build a bot if you're a C# developer already. You have to build it once and deploy in many channels. And then there's the, you can build them for fun and do something cool, like the app ecosystem, or you can build it for work. So hopefully this was a good base review of what the bots can do for you, and you can take it back to your work and build a couple bots that either entertain you or help you do your work better. Thanks, I'm Daniel Egan, and appreciate you guys coming by.